I wanted to bring to your attention this morning a few things, but before I start in, I just want to tell you how fun it is to see brothers in Christ and how wonderful it is to feel the encouragement that we have. Just a note about where I stayed with Pastor Scott and Teresa Dean in Ohio, and their church was actually hosting the conference this week. And I've known Scott Dean since I was much younger and had the privilege of getting to serve with him several times at camps and different things. And so it was really great to connect with him and his wife again. And they have goats. How many of you like goats? I love goats. So they have a couple of goats. It was fun to go out and see their goats. They have a horse. It was great to go out and say good morning to the horse in the morning. They have several dogs. They have chickens. And so it was fun to be able to stay with them and to see their animals and visit with them. There was a lot discussed at our ministers' conference this week. And a lot of that I'm not going to bring back to you, because it's just kind of the nature of that. But there is something that we wanted to talk about, and something that's pretty important. I want to talk to you this morning about God's deliverance. God's deliverance. How many of you have ever needed God to deliver you from something? Bring you through a situation or bring you through a temptation or whatever it is. You need God's deliverance. You need his help. Well, right now, it's a very special time of year. I want to go ahead and, now Dave, I want you to know this is the most writing you're going to have today, okay? So, God's deliverance. Right now, on your calendar, you may have noticed coming up, some of you have all the different holidays on the calendar. You know how they list those. The festival of Purim is coming up. And Purim is a feast day that is celebrated by the Jews. Now, it's the feast day that commemorates the deliverance of the Jews from destruction when they were in Persian captivity. You might remember that some of the Jews were taken captive to Babylon and that they were in captivity in Persia for quite some time. So, now this celebration commemorates when they were delivered from Haman, who had hatched an evil plot against them. Now, someone once asked me in a youth group, they said, "Why is everyone always picking on the Jews?" And I said, well, they're God's chosen people, and they get picked on a lot. And throughout history, the story has not changed. We can even think about times today where it hasn't changed, where they get picked on, and you ever wonder why Jerusalem is always in the news? Well, that's why, because it's the center of the world. So, the root word of Purim is the root word put, meaning lot, because Haman cast lots to determine when he should carry out his evil plan against the Jews. So that's the root word of where Purim, the word Purim, comes from. Now, here's the important part. Usually Purim is celebrated on the 14th and 15th of Adar, okay? Now, this year, it happens to be Tuesday, March 7th. Okay, in 2023, it happens to be Tuesday, March 7th. But it actually starts, like, the sundown of the evening before. So it would be sundown March 6th through the day on March 7th till sundown. So remember, the Jewish days begin at sundown and go until sundown. Okay? So that's how they do their days. So the good news is, now lots of celebrations in the Jewish festivals, some of them are, you know, they do fasting and they do different things. This one, not so much. This one, it's a happy celebration where the book of Esther is read, and it's accompanied by the giving of gifts. So to that end, Riley, could I ask for your help for a moment? I was trying to think of what kind of gift I could give out this morning. And I'm still catching up from being away. But I think these are all individually wrapped, I'm hoping. So you can just hand everyone who would like one an envelope that with candy in it. So I wanted to give you a gift this morning. And I hope there's one left for me. You can have an after eight, if you would like, as a gift to celebrate upcoming Purim. Okay, I didn't want to come and speak on Purim without a gift to give. So if you would like to turn to the book of Esther with me, you can turn to the book of Esther. And Dave, we're going to not change the slide just yet so you can have a chance to write it all down well. For those of you who don't know, Dave faithfully takes notes each Sunday, and he gives them out to about four or five other people who either can't be here or are connected or who he'd like to have see come here. So he wants them to be sure to have God's word. Now, who remembers Esther? Does anyone remember Esther? You remember Esther? Now, how many of you have ever seen a beauty pageant? Have you seen a beauty pageant? Here she comes, Miss America, right? So there's lots of preparation that goes into a beauty pageant. And the beginning of the book of Esther, there is a beauty pageant of sorts that starts to happen. Now, I was looking up all sorts of interesting little strange facts. The average American woman apparently can spend up to about $300 a month on her appearance. I thought, wow, I'm underspending. But that's okay. That was an average. The average American woman will spend $300 on their appearance, on beauty products and beauty treatments each month. That's a lot of money. A lot of money. However, if you rack up all the costs, it could be that much. I don't know if you've ever tried a day at a spa anywhere around here, but boy, you don't want to take it lightly. It's an expensive adventure. Now, here's a little background information about Esther. And we're going to look at the book of Esther. In Esther, it's not entirely about Esther. There was a queen before Esther. Her name was Vashti. And King Ahasuerus had a wife named Vashti. And she did fine until one day she decided, when the king called for her, that she was not going to come. And this caused great distress for King Ahasuerus. It caused him embarrassment, and his trusted counselor friend Memucan said to him, you know, when women across Persia find out that Vashti has ignored the request of the king, women all over the province are going to start being disrespectful to their husbands, just like Vashti was disrespectful to you. And so they disposed of Queen Vashti as the queen. And so they decided that they would have a beauty pageant, more or less, to have a new wife be selected for King Ahasuerus. Are you okay there, Dave? You're done? Can I change the slide? You're all done with this slide? Okay, well, we'll add that on later. Okay, so we're going to look at the book of Esther, and this is just a picture of what Esther may have looked like. We don't know for sure. In Esther chapter 2, and we're going to be kind of skipping through along, hitting some verses, leaving out some others, but you'll get the story. You'll get what happens. In Esther 2, it says, after these things, as the rage of King Ahasuerus abated, he became mindful of Vashti, which she had done, and what was decreed against her. So the king's servants who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom so that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to the citadel of Susa, to the harem under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the harem, and let ointments and cosmetics be given to them. May the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." And the idea pleased the king, so he acted accordingly. This man was willing to spend money. He was willing to spend money to find a wife. Now, in the citadel of Susa, there was a certain Jew named Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. He had been taken away from Jerusalem among the exiles and carried into captivity, along with King Jeconiah and of Judah, by King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. That should ring some bells for you. Okay. He was the guardian of Hadassah, that is, Esther, who was his uncle's daughter. Because she had neither father nor mother, the young woman was lovely to look at and beautiful in form. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. And I am reading from the Modern English Version this morning. When the king's notice and his decree were heard, many young women were then gathered to the citadel of Susa and placed under the custody of Haggai. Esther was likewise brought to the king's house and placed under the custody of Haggai, who was in charge of the harem. Because the young lady appeared pleasing to him and gained favor in his sight, he quickly gave her the ointments and cosmetics, her allotted food, and 7 young chosen women from the king's palace. He also transferred her and the young women to the best place of the harem. Esther had not disclosed her people or her lineage because Mordecai had charged her not to disclose it. Every day Mordecai walked around the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther fared and what might be done with her. The turn came for each young woman to go into King Ahasuerus after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying. 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for women. This is a 12-month preparation. How many of us spend about maybe 5-10 minutes in the morning getting ready to go out the door? This was 12 months of beauty treatments. 12 months of beauty treatments. I sure hope that I was going to make a joke about they were either awfully ugly or they needed a lot of help. They must be pretty darn beautiful after they get out of those beauty treatments. 12 months. Well, you know, it mentions that it was frankincense that and myrrh. Well, not frankincense, but myrrh and other spices. Myrrh especially. Myrrh is a reddish-brown dried sap from a thorny tree. It's called Commiphora myrrha, also known as C. mulmul. It's native to northern Africa and southwest Asia. It can be quite expensive if you try and buy oil of myrrh. However, it also acts as a way of cleansing. It gets rid of bacteria. It can get rid of bacteria. It has all sorts of different health benefits and beauty properties to it, as well as it smells great. Okay? So if you're going to come before the king and hope to be chosen, you want to look your best. And these 12 months of beauty treatments are what happened for those ladies before they went in. I have a hard time wrapping my mind around that. I just have a hard time wrapping my mind around that. I think I would get bored with that, with that much preparation. I don't know. I'm sure that they probably included things like what to do at the dinner table, what kind of silverware to use, those kinds of things, whatever the etiquette of the day was. I'm sure that they were also informed of those things during this year-long training. But they went through quite a process, these women did. Picking up at verse 13. When the young woman went in to the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to take to the king's palace. In the evening she went in, and in the morning she returned to the second harem in custody of Shajagaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She did not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter, to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what the king's eunuch, Haggai, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus at his royal house in the month of Tebeth, which is the 10th month in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than any other woman because she had gained grace and favor in his sight more than all the other virgins. So he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. The king held a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was a feast for Esther. He remitted his provinces from tax payments and gave gifts according to his royal generosity. You all just received a gift, right? Hopefully it was a good one. Now, here's where the plot thickens. This story isn't just about Esther. It's about something else. At the second gathering of the virgins, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not yet disclosed her lineage or her people, since Mordecai had so commanded her. Esther followed the command of Mordecai just as she had under protection. During those days, when Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, who served as keepers of the door, became angry and sought to attack King Ahasuerus. But the matter became known to Mordecai, and he reported it to Queen Esther, and Esther reported it to the king in the name of Mordecai. When the matter was investigated and confirmed, both men were hanged to the gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. So Mordecai learns of this plot, and he informs Esther, and Esther lets the king know that there are people who are not for him, who are against him. And Mordecai saves Ahasuerus from being murdered. Now, going onward, it says, after these things, King Ahasuerus praised Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and promoted him and set his seat above all the officials who were with him. All the king's servants, when they were at the king's gate, bowed or paid homage to Haman, since the king had commanded it. Mordecai, however, never bowed or paid homage. So the king's servants, tending the king's gate, said to Mordecai, "Why are you transgressing the king's commandment?" Though they spoke to him daily, he never listened to them. So they reported it to Haman to see if the words of Mordecai would stand. For Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed nor paid him homage, he was filled with rage. But he disdained to lay hands on only Mordecai, since they had told him of the people of Mordecai. So Haman sought to destroy all the Jews throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. I mean, it's one thing to have something against one person. But when you say, because I don't like what this one person did, I'm going to kill their whole nation, all of them that are of that nationality, that is really wrong, isn't it? It's really wrong. I want to bring something to modern day. There was a lot of Asian hate that happened in the last couple of years because of COVID and because that was brought over from China and so forth. There are people out there who think that every Asian person in Canada is responsible for COVID being here, which is ludicrous thinking. Do you agree that's ludicrous thinking? But it happens. And it happens and it manifests as Asian hate. I have a friend whose mother is the sweetest person. And she likes to go out for a walk, just go out for a walk around the block. But she won't go out for a walk around the block anymore. Because there are some guys in a pickup truck that yell nasty things at her every time she goes for a walk. Just because she's Asian. And I'm telling you, this lady is a sweet lady, would never hurt a fly. You know, wonderful woman. That's the kind of thinking that Haman had in here. Which is ludicrous kind of thinking. Because he didn't like one person who was Jewish. He was going to knock out all of the Jewish people in Persia. In fact, he even built gallows to hang them on. Because he was determined he was going to get rid of all of them. Moving on in this story. We're going to look at verse 8. It says, "Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, 'There exists a scattered people dispersed among the other peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all others, and they are not complying with the king's laws. So there may not be a suitable reason for the king to allow them to exist. If it pleases the king, may it be written that they are to be destroyed. And may there be 10,000 talents of silver deposited into the king's treasuries so that I may distribute it to the hands of those doing the work.'" Not only is it bad enough he's doing it, now he wants to drag others into it too. And he's trying to persuade the king. "The king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. The king said to Haman, 'The silver has been granted to you, as have the people. So do with each as it pleases you.'" That's a rough situation to be in. We're going to skip to chapter 4 at the beginning of Esther. "When Mordecai learned all that had been done, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth with ashes and went out into the midst of the city and cried with a loud and bitter cry. He went as far as the king's gate because no one was allowed to enter into the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. In each and every province where the king's command and his decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews and fasting and weeping and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. So the young women of Esther and her eunuchs came and told her of it. The queen was then seized by anguish. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he could remove his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. So Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs appointed to attend her, and commanded him concerning Mordecai to learn what this was about and why. So Hathach went out to where Mordecai was in the area of the city in front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him about all that had happened to him and about the sum of silver that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa concerning their destruction, so he could show Esther, tell her about it, and then charge her to go to the king in order to gain him favor with the king and to make requests in the presence of the king of her people. Hathach returned and told Esther the words of Mordecai. Again, Esther spoke to Hathach and ordered him to reply to Mordecai, "All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that whoever, whether man or woman, wishes to come to the king at the inner court but has not been summoned, there is one law to put him to death, unless for some reason the king should hold out the golden scepter so that he might live. I, however, have not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days." So all the words of Esther were told to Mordecai. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not think that in the king's palace you will be more likely to escape than all the other Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, protection and deliverance for the Jews will be ordained from some other place, but you and your father's house shall be destroyed. And who knows if you may have attained royal position for such a time as this?" Then Esther replied, sending back to Mordecai, "Go gather all the Jews who can be found in Susa, then fast for me. Stop eating and drinking for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will fast likewise. Only then would I dare go to the king, since it is not allowed by law. And if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went away and did exactly as Esther had commanded him. I want us to think a little bit more on this. Esther's in a really bad position. She's in a bad position. She's not been summoned. If she goes, she interrupts the king's court. She goes in there. If he doesn't extend that royal golden scepter, that's the end. She has to be brave. She has to be brave. She does go in. The king extends the royal scepter. She doesn't die. And he says, "What can I do for you?" She says, "I'd like to invite you to a banquet." And so she throws a banquet. She throws a banquet in which she invites the king and she invites Mordecai. Not Mordecai, Haman. Thank you. She invites Haman and the king. Now, at the first night, the king is so pleased with the dinner. He says, "What is it that I can do for you, my dear?" More or less. And she says, "Come to another banquet tomorrow night." He comes to another banquet. He's very pleased. He says, "What can I do for you?" She says, "Come to one more dinner." And on the third night, they go to the dinner. And the king is asking her a few questions. Now, in the meantime, some interesting things have happened. The king remembers how Mordecai saved his life, and he says, "What's been done for this dude? Did we do anything for him?" And they say, "No." So, unbeknownst to Haman, the king says to Haman, "Now, what should be done for someone whom I really delight in?" And he says, "You know, he should get to ride on the royal horse with a royal robe," because Haman thinks that it's himself that is going to get to do this reward, right? Because he and the king are buddies. Imagine Haman's mortification when the king says, "Remember that guy Mordecai who helped save my life? I want you to do that for him. Go get my royal horse. Go get my royal robe. Stick it on him and have him ride throughout the city." Not quite how Haman had designed his plan, was it? So here he is. Haman is leading Mordecai, whom he hates the guts of for no good reason. He has to lead him through the city on the king's horse and dressed in the king's royal robes. Now, this has happened in between. Now, they get to this last night where Esther has invited the king and Haman to the banquet. And I want us to think a little bit on this. Let's see. It says in chapter 7, "So the king and Haman entered to feast and drink with Queen Esther. The king repeated to Esther what he had said on the previous day while drinking wine. 'For what are you asking, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. Now what is your request? Even if it is half of the kingdom, it will be done.' Queen Esther replied, 'If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, at my petition, let my life be given me, and my people at my request. For we have been sold, and I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to be annihilated. If only we had been sold as male and female slaves, I could have kept quiet. for that distress would not be sufficient to trouble the king. Then King Ahasuerus answered and demanded of Queen Esther, "Who is he and where is he? Who would dare presume in his heart to do so?" In other words, he's saying, who wants to take your life? I'm not, you know, this is where the male protector comes out, right? He goes, who's threatening my wife? I don't like this. The king, let's see. Esther said, this wicked Haman is the adversary and enemy. Then Haman was seized with terror before the king and the queen. And the king arose from the banquet of wine with wine in his wrath and went into the palace garden. But Haman remained to plead for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. You think? You find out the guy that you've been buddy-buddy with is trying to kill your wife. Not so good. Now the king returned from the palace garden back to the hall of the banquet as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, will he also violate the queen while I am in the room? He's saying, to add injury to insult, this is just too much. As the shout erupted from the king's mouth, they covered the face of Haman. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in the king's presence, said, the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman had constructed for Mordecai, who had spoken good on behalf of the king, stands at the house of Haman. Then the king said, hang him on it. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's wrath was pacified. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. Mordecai came before the king because Esther disclosed who he was to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. Then Esther spoke again to the king and fell down at his feet and begged him with tears to avert the evil of Haman the Agagite and the scheme that he had devised against the Jews. Because remember, his command had gone throughout all of Persia, right? To kill all the Jews. If it pleases the king and if I have found favor in his sight and the idea seems right before the king and I have his approval, then let it be written to reverse the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews in all the king's provinces. For how am I able to watch the evil that will unfold against my people? How can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai, the Jew, see, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows because he threatened violence against the Jews. Now, as it suits you, write in the king's name on behalf of the Jews and seal it with the king's signet ring, because a document written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring cannot be repealed. So here's what happens. In the original letters, it said, on this particular day, the Persians could avenge themselves on the Jews, and they were allowed to go in and annihilate all the Jews. That couldn't be revoked. But what could be written was that on that same day that every Jew was able to defend themselves and that they were able to avenge anyone who came against them, and that they would it would not be held against them. So when the second letter that was written kind of made it to nullify the first letter that was written. And none of the Jews were harmed. They were allowed to live because it became a no-win situation for either party. And everything just kind of stayed the same as it was, and no lives were lost. Now, Esther delivered her people, but it wasn't just Esther. It was really God's deliverance. God's deliverance. There are a couple of things that I want us to notice. The things I want us to notice about how God's deliverance came about, the things I want us to notice are that God would be faithful to his promise whether or not Esther was willing to work on behalf of her people. Do you remember that verse that we read where it said that if she didn't move, that salvation would come from another place? Let's see, I'm looking for that. It is in, thank you, in 4:14. For if you remain silent at this time, protection and deliverance for the Jews will be ordained from some other place, but you and your father's house shall be destroyed. And who knows if you may have attained royal position for such a time as this. God had already said that there was going to be deliverance, whether it came through Esther or through someone else. The next thing, she was willing to listen to wise counsel. She listened to the king's attendant, first of all, to get into the best position to become queen. And she also listened to her uncle Mordecai. She listened to her uncle Mordecai. He had wise counsel for her, and she would listen to it. Next, God put her in a position of authority. As queen, she had a certain amount of authority. And God put her in a good position to be able to speak to the king. Because not everyone could just go in and speak to the king. You had to be summoned. The king wouldn't summon just anyone. He would only summon the people who were close to him or who he needed. So, God put her in a position of authority. God gave her the ability to gain the favor of the king. He gave her the ability to gain the favor of the king. When she first was becoming queen, and even after she was queen, she knew what her husband liked. Okay? And that was good. It worked to her benefit. She was able to gain the favor of the king. Now, that favor, God works within hearts. God knew what he was doing when he touched Ahasuerus' heart and said, she's the girl for you. And then touched his heart again when he said, told his King Ahasuerus, give her whatever she'd like. Right? God influences our hearts and our minds. Now, next, she knew how to employ diplomacy. What do I mean by that? She knew that Haman was the one who was going to destroy the Jews. She knew that he was the one with the evil plot. She invited him to the dinner too. That takes guts. She could have just asked the king privately, you know, and not invited Haman. How many of us invite our enemies to dinner? If there's someone who's trying to kill you, do you invite them over for supper? Not usually. And she did it like 3 nights in a row. Brave woman. Right? But it was an act of diplomacy. It was an act of saying, I am looking at this from even keel, from a queen perspective. I am looking at this as this is your friend. This is a person of importance that you would want to have at a dinner with you. Okay. It also makes it look really gross because Haman enjoyed the dinners too, right? He enjoyed the dinners too. And then when you look at the big picture for King Ahasuerus, who's, you know, trying to wrap his mind all over this, he's seen that Haman has enjoyed the dinners and that she's also invited Haman to the dinners. And then it just makes it look even worse, right, on Haman's behalf. It makes it look worse on his behalf. Most importantly, and this is the most important thing, most importantly, She invoked the blessing of God by asking her people to pray for her as she approached the king on their behalf. And I love this picture, and I'll translate it for you sort of closely. También ora por mí means also pray for me, or as well pray for me. So Esther is talking with Mordecai, and she's saying, pray for me as I go in before the king. Not only was she to pray for her people, but they were to pray for her, and how important that was. That was probably one of the most single most important things she did. That picture just, it speaks to me in a deep way. Now, I want us to kind of think just a little bit further on this. And we are wrapping this up, just so you know. How do we operate when we need God's deliverance? How do we operate when we need God's deliverance? Well, we should pray, right? We should pray, and we should also ask others to pray as well. That's what we need to do, ask others to pray as well. And we should pray ourselves. Another thing we should do is we should take advantage of the gifts, abilities, or positions he's placed us in to work within his will. Our sphere of influence. Everyone has a sphere of influence. He may have placed you in just the right place for just the right time. And I can give you a lot of different examples of that, of how we can sometimes be in the right position to bless God's people. How we can just be a blessing and be able to do that. We should take advantage of those things. God doesn't do anything by happenstance. He's got a master plan, and the way he works it out is beautiful. We should recognize and remember that it was God who provided the deliverance and not we ourselves. It's God who provides the deliverance and not we ourselves. It's not our talent. It's not our abilities. He's given us those to work with, but it's really him who's working with us and through us to work out his will. So he gets all the glory. God gets all the glory. In the story of Esther, God gets the glory. She gets some of it because she was brave, but it was really God working behind the scenes throughout the whole thing. You see his finger. In the book of Esther, God is never mentioned once. God's never mentioned once, but you see his fingerprint right through the whole book and the way everything plays out. You see his fingerprint there. I want to leave us with this thought this morning. You turn to the book of Psalms with me. In the book of Psalms, when we are in distress, when we need deliverance, I want us to think about these two psalms. In Psalm 142, this is a person who is crying out to God for help. It says, I cried unto the Lord with my voice. With my voice I made my supplication unto the Lord. I poured out my complaint before him. I declared to him my trouble. When my spirit was overwhelmed within me, then you knew my path. In the way where I walk, they have laid a snare for me. I looked on my right and noticed, but there was no one who would care for me. There is no refuge for me. No one cares for my soul. I cried unto you, O Lord. I said, you are my refuge and my portion in the land of the living. Attend to my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are stronger than me. Bring my soul out of prison that I may praise your name. The righteous shall surround me, for you shall deal bountifully with me. This is a prayer that's coming from the heart of one who needs deliverance. When that deliverance comes, I want to share with you Psalm 146. It says, "Praise the Lord. Praise the Lord, O my soul. While I live, I will praise the Lord. I will sing praises unto my God while I have my life. Do not put your trust in princes, nor in the son of man, nor in a son of man, in whom there is no help. His breath leaves him, and he returns to the earth. On that very day, his plans perish. Blessed is he who has the God of Jacob for his help, whose hope is in the Lord his God, who made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, who keeps faithfulness forever, who executes justice for the oppressed, who gives food to the hungry. The Lord releases the prisoners. The Lord opens the eyes of the blind. The Lord raises those who are brought down. The Lord loves the righteous. The Lord preserves the sojourners. He lifts up the fatherless and widow, but on the way of the wicked he brings disaster. The Lord shall reign forever, your God, O Zion, unto all generations." This is the one who's been brought through the time, who's been delivered, and they're praising God and telling of his wonderful acts. When you come into a situation where you need deliverance, God is mighty and strong. He's there to help you. He's there to listen. This is what God does. This is what he does for those who love him and call upon him. Just like the Jews called upon him for deliverance, you can call upon him too in times where you might need deliverance from something. A situation, a sin, something private. They're all things that we need deliverance from. I ask this morning that you would go ahead and trust the Lord to deliver you in situations where you need him to.